This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 290 was recorded on September 23rd, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. JDI Research founder Julia DeClercq returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll cover the whole macro picture and then translate those ideas to actionable market strategies. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick's chart deck will be titled, Is the Market Correction Over?
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's look at that S&P 500. I mean, we had, obviously, since the last episode, a pretty definitive breakdown one day that saw a 2, 3% drop. And then just like that in the post-FOMC, it seems like we're right back, at least back to a very neutral zone at this moment, back above the 50-day moving average. Do you think that that was it for the market correction, or is there more selling to come?
I think that was probably it. And yeah, I could be wrong here, Patrick, but the way I see this is everybody's talking about, boy, weakness in the market. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, look at the size of the 2013 taper tantrum. We've just gone through essentially the same type of announcement from the Fed, basically saying, you know, we're getting ready to taper any day soon here. We're going to start tapering. And I'm sure that the when they're going to taper and how much they're going to taper is going to change five more times before this is over. But we're getting the message that's kind of the big feared thing, that they're taking their foot off the accelerator. And finally, we got a break below the 50-day moving average all the way down to the 100-day moving average, which lasted all of a day and a half. And now we're vigorously bouncing off of it. I see this as they bought the 100-day dip instead of the 50-day dip because it was kind of a big deal with the taper announcement. And that's all behind us. And the whole thing lasted less than a week. I don't see it as a big deal. Could be wrong.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar, because the dollar got right back up to those August highs around 93.50. But initially today, at least, it stalled up along those highs. What's in store for the dollar in your mind?
Beats me. I mean, we're at the same place we've been, which is stuck in this consolidation pattern. We're getting close to the top of that consolidation range, but haven't broken out above it yet. Until we do, as far as I'm concerned, it's basically a, you know, it's a range-bound market. In theory, we're getting pretty close to the sell point if you're a swing trader, although I do think that an upside breakout is a very real possibility. It hasn't come yet.
All right, well, let's talk crude oil, because that's where there is definitely some relative strength. I mean, two back-to-back days now of crude oil strength that was now approaching that 52-week high, or at least a summer high, and looks like it might break out. Are you bullish here, oil? Is this going up to 80 or something?
I sure think so. And of course, once again, Patrick, you left out the four critical words, as predicted on Macro Voices, because this is exactly what I really was convinced was happening, was the bull market was on pause. Why was it on pause? Because everybody thought August was going to be the wipeout month in terms of inventory drawdowns, and that never happened because of the Delta strain and everything else. Now, all of a sudden, we're realizing, hey, it's September, and guess what? Demand didn't fall off dramatically. As Phil Verleger told us, construction season, which is going to be extended this year, will keep demand strong, and I think we're seeing the resumption of a rally. I still think that the target price range is somewhere above 80 and below $92, and I thought that was going to happen before Labor Day. Obviously, I was wrong on that one. I still think it's coming before the end of the year, and I think we're probably getting to over $100 in 2022.
Eric, how did the inventory numbers come in?
Crude oil drawing down 3.5 million barrels. That's a significant drawdown, but you know, it's only half as big as last week, so it wasn't quite as scary as some people feared. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 1.5 million barrels. Gasoline building 3.5 million barrels. That was the surprise on the board, but distillates still drawing down 2.6 million barrels. U.S. production up 500,000 barrels to 10.6 million, but still significantly depressed from before Hurricane Ida. So we've got about 500,000 barrels of production still offline from Ida in the U.S. Gulf of Mexico. As far as the tape action after inventory, we got a bit of a rally going on before the data. And then, of course, after the data, it just kept going. And, of course, this morning, Thursday, was the real rocket ship day. I do think this continues. At this point, we've got a pretty good size 5-day gap brewing here. We're already over $2. So I think some kind of pullback or at least slowdown in the action is in order. But I do think we've begun a march higher toward 80 plus.
All right, well, we got to touch on gold here. It reversed off that 750 low late last week and suddenly looked like it was ready to go. And here we are back at 1750 again with a little bit of weakness this morning. It's really, gold can't seem to get out of its way, at least on the short term. What's your take on how gold is trading here?
Well, frankly, this chart's looking kind of concerning, Patrick. We had that fake breakout that happened back at the beginning of September above the moving averages, and that, of course, reversed right at 1830, where the market has found really strong resistance all the way back to June. What's happening now, we got the breakdown, and then it seemed like we were going to have a recovery rally. We got right up to the 13-day moving average. That's the highest of the three short-term moving averages. A breakout above that would have signaled maybe a trend change, and right on that technical level, we saw the reversal, and now we've broken down below the 5, 8, and 13-day moving averages. If we close down here, it's a bearish signal. It suggests that the trend is down.
All right, well, we have to touch on that 10-year Treasury yield because really for the last month, month and a half, we've been in an incredibly tight trade range and it looked like yields were just pinned. But in this post-FOMC, there's a clear breakout on the upside of yields up to 1.40, which is it policy error in your mind? Like what's going on in the bond market?
Well, Patrick, all this discussion of taper and what does it mean and are they really going to do it and how long is it going to take and so forth is a pretty big event in the bond market. I look at this as I'm not sure it's policy error. I think it's just the market's absorbing all of this news that's happened. I don't see 10 basis points as that big of a deal, or maybe it's 15 basis points from where we were a week ago, but I don't see it as that big of a deal and I don't see this as the beginning of a trend. I'm waiting to see what happens.
This week's feature interview guest is JDI Research founder Juliette DeClercq. Now, Eric, why did we invite Juliette back on the show this week?
Patrick, Juliette is one of our all-time listener favorites and a Macro Voices regular. It's been too long since we had her on the show. I wanted to get her back because she's got the European perspective being based in London. And I think it's a time, although we did tape this interview before the FOMC statement, it's definitely when you get to its central bank season, you'll want to get Juliette's perspective and see what she sees on the horizon.
Eric's interview with Juliette DeClercq is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Abex, a fintech company traded under ticker symbol ABXXF on the OTCQX in the United States and ABXX on the Equitas Neo in Canada. Abex was founded on the principle of creating market-based solutions to solve the world's most challenging problems. Two of these issues in particular, the energy transition and climate change, are creating once-in-a-generation opportunities for investors. Abex is leveraging proprietary Web 3.0 technologies to digitize and accelerate the velocity and security of commodity trading markets, beginning with liquefied natural gas and carbon. Investors seeking exposure to the fintech applications powering this new era of the ESG economy can visit www.abex.tech or www.abex.exchange, or check out ABXX on the Equitas Neo or ABXXF on the OTCQX exchanges.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Juliette DeClercq, founder of JDI Research. Juliette has prepared a slide deck for us for today's interview. Listeners will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says looking for the downloads. Juliet, markets have been directionless and a little bit difficult for the past few months. Now, you specialize in splitting out underlying trends from noises. So how about if we start with your macro diagnostic since we last spoke?
So let me think about when we last spoke. I think it was in March when we were nearing a macro inflection point. And you've got a great timing in re-inviting me on your show, Eric, because I think we're nearing another inflection point, which normally should mean good trading opportunities. So let's start with what really happened since we last spoke. If you check chart 1 and 2 of the chart pack that I produced for your listeners, you will see that the reflation trade, which started on the COVID vaccine in early November 2020, and which consensus strongly believed was going to be the main theme in 2021, has now fully unwound. And unsurprisingly, cyclical stocks and real yields were the main casualties. It's also interesting to note that the peak in real yields and cyclical outperformance also coincided with a global demand peak, as shown by the peak in the global PMI survey. So what really happened? I think the answer is that investors grew too comfortable, as normally happens in early year, but this year was like a particularly was different because of like the massive leverage that was available in market. So I think investors grew too comfortable in big size with the narrative of the grand recovery trade and the view that cyclicals would basically sell into the sunset. When consensus is overwhelming, it doesn't take much to disrupt trends. And inevitably, three things ruined the party. One, higher production costs and persistent supply bottlenecks, curtailing companies' growth potential. Two, the secondary effect of higher prices, suppressing consumption. And three, obviously, the rise of the Delta variant this summer, depressing animal spirits, just as most of the developed world were starting to see light at the end of the COVID tunnel. So let me start here with the global supply chain crunch. Instead of seeing an easing in 2021, we actually experienced a worsening far beyond the one seen in 2020. We can blame a front-loading of Christmas orders and Delta-induced port closures in Asia. I was speaking just last week to a luxury perfume maker in France, and they would have had their absolute best year ever in 2021 if it wasn't for the fact that they can't deliver on orders. It's not the glass bottles that are made in France or Italy, but what they're missing is basically the plastic tops that are made in China. The issue is that the explosion of globalization in the past two decades, goods production depends on intricately intertwined global supply chains. I'm not teaching you anything here. A missing link can delay production tremendously, and persistent semiconductor shortages is another prime example. Meanwhile, global manufacturers face bidding wars for space on vessels, pushing freight rates to records, as you can see on chart 3. So even if you did manage to get your orders shipped, cost pressures remain acute, and we are yet to see a peak there. There is really no secret. You get price inflation when the money supply, which tends to lead global demand, rises much faster than the supply of products and services. And as shown on chart 4, the global bottlenecks index has now peaked, but it remains extreme historically. So the question going forward is whether production will eventually catch up to strong demand as the supply crunch eases, or whether inflation will eventually kill reflation in the stagflation scenario that we have been pricing since May.
Okay, Juliet, so what's your take on the subject of final demand being heavily constrained by higher prices? Do you agree with markets' pricing of inflation being transitory because higher prices eventually curb demand as the supply side normalizes, leading to a supply-demand rebalancing and a return to the Great Moderation?
Well, to be fair, this is something I really focused on in the past few weeks, and my initial answer would be that indeed, it would appear that global demand has suffered a mortal blow. in Asia, for example, new orders actually fell into contractionary territory for the first time since July 2020, and inventories have started to normalize. That plunged the manufacturing sector's leading indicator for the region into the danger zone and raising red flags over the cyclical outlook. And that's something you can show for yourself on chart 5 of my chart pack. Of course, there's good news there as well, because normalizing inventories in Asia should go a long way to start alleviating supply chain constraints in the West. But on the same chart, you can also observe that all manufacturing leading indicators have indeed peaked. And the natural conclusion is that softer demand trends should indeed allow a return to a macroeconomic equilibrium, which guarantees the 2021 burst of goods inflation is a one-off that would fit the Fed's transitory narrative. And that's something you can see on chart 6. Truth be told, the most recent consumer surveys do fit this narrative. If you take the Michigan Index, which was the first to smell troubles because its granularity gives a good read on real income expectations rather than just income expectations. So you realize that elevated prices are as much of a drag on sentiment as the Delta variant, which hit hard this summer. That's something that you can see on chart 7. So basically, ordinary folks are fretting far more about their purchasing power than about their jobs. And the particularity of this crisis is that it did not rebuild, but actually initially killed purchasing power. So to your initial question of whether inflation has killed reflation, it would appear that markets are right to price that it is indeed the case. And on this, looked no further than the last conference board survey, which basically joined the Michigan survey in describing a situation where the consumer's purchasing power is a problem, with purchasing plans falling below their 12-month moving average for all durables. That's on chart 8. But really, I would argue that there is a lot more to inflation than the good story.
Juliet, it sounds like you're implying that markets are missing some important piece of this macro puzzle. Is that right? And if so, which one? And do you know what the answer is?
So I'm trying to. That's what I am tried to develop in my last report. Just two things. Firstly, that's two charts that I've added for your listeners. That's charts 15 and 16. The first one is the ISM manufacturing, which in fact was much more optimistic than market as to the fate of the manufacturing sector in the US. And the truth is that I've been shocked by the strength of demand, if you're looking at business survey rather than consumer survey, despite higher prices. The business surveys actually point to production catching up to strong demand as supply bottlenecks start easing rather than the opposite. And secondly, the global services sector is a bit weaker this summer on the Delta variant, but leading indicators remain historically very strong. So there is a case to be made that services will drive global activity stronger, but that manufacturing will not collapse and be as weak as some of the consensus expects. But more importantly, I want to come back to inflation. There's basically two types of inflation. There's the so-called first-round inflation, which basically is higher prices. And this one is clearly self-limiting. All else equal, higher prices end up curbing demand and indicate mean reversion in prices ahead. So that's never something that's really worrying for a central bank. And to be objective, this is all we've seen in our investing life, because central banks are dead paranoid about second-round inflation and tend to kill it in the nest. Why? Because secondary effects from the initial inflation spike come via higher wages catching up to higher prices. That's a process called a wage-price spiral. And the problem with the wage-price spiral is that it is self-perpetuating rather than self-limiting like the first round would be, because real wage growth feeds into higher demand and then back into higher prices. So this means that second round inflation is actually reflationary, whilst the first round of inflation is contractionary. You get the drill. Secondary effects are much harder to control, and it results that most central banks have tended to lean against true inflation for decades, which also somewhat explains why real salaries have been diverging from productivity and the reason why purchasing power has been curbed so drastically over the past few decades. What I'm arguing today is that the COVID crisis has sparked a macro paradigm shift away from a world order that I just described that had become basically unsustainable because of collapsing purchasing power. Why? Well, think about it, because we've entered a new era for the, especially for the US labor market. It's a bit of a similar effect to the World War II effect, which started the trend in Europe of women joining the labor force as a result of the initial squeeze in the male workforce, simply because of a large share, you know, basically being busy in the trenches. In the same way, many US workers today are having a complete rethink about their dead-end jobs, which explains why the quit rate is surprisingly at all-time high just after a downturn. And that's something you will see on chart 9. I strongly believe that perspectives are changing, priorities are shifting, and after being forced to stay at home, burned out by having to educate kids at home, but at the same time flushed with savings, workers now have the luxury of having a deep thinking about what they really want. So what do they really want? Continue to work from home, to be away from big cities, get vaccinated to get a job? Are they desperate to go back to the office? The problem is that basically lowers the labor force and increases structural unemployment. The second thing is that this sort of like a trend also combines with baby boomers retiring at a faster clip than pre-crisis. And surveys also show that 3 million over 55s are now considering early retirement. I think there is also, and most definitely, the effect of easy money. You basically find that all the workers that actually had savings have seen their retirement portfolio explode over the crisis. And I'm hearing more and more younger workers actually find that trading crypto or buying equity dips is a lot easier than getting a traditional job. So I think it's somewhat naive to blame the slower than expected employment recovery on the supplementary employment benefits, which are now expiring. I believe that labor shortage will persist for years to come and that structural unemployment will move higher. And the result is that against all expectations, Philip Curve effects may come back with a vengeance.
Well, you know, when trading crypto with no trading experience seems more opportune than getting a job, what could go wrong?
Exactly.
Juliet, I hear you on the labor shortage, but isn't this just another piece of the stagflation puzzle? I mean, after all, consensus is strongly of the view that weak demographics and the shrinking labor force is what's actually depressing real growth potential. And we've had full employment in the past with a dead Phillips curve.
Eric, I think you're absolutely right on weak demographics. But there are two ways to grow aggregate earnings. And obviously, we've forgotten about the two ways because the last three decades have seen no increase in real earnings. But the fact is that you can grow aggregate earnings via growing aggregate hours worked from employment or employment, or by increasing hourly earnings or real earnings. And my belief is that the labor market squeeze that we're currently seeing will lead to higher real wages because the large increase in workers' bargaining power is actually this time combined with exploding inflation expectations. And that's something that you can see for yourself on chart 10. Basically, it's one thing to not use your bargaining power with no inflation at full employment, but it's a completely other one to remain silent when your rent is expected to rise at double digits next year. So I'm convinced that persistently high inflation expectations will drive workers to use their increased bargaining power to defend their purchasing power. In our last interview, I argued that the pandemic's fiscal giveaways would buy workers the serenity to rethink their return to the labor market, and that such non-urgency, if we can say, would increase their bargaining power, which is basically a side effect of socialism, something that I know quite a bit about, being French. It's already happening, in fact. Workers are now seeking to benefit from the hot labor market in the US, and especially in the most disrupted sectors like leisure and hospitality and transportation and warehousing. It's really interesting to see that a recent survey by Indeed showed that COVID fears are no longer the main reason for avoiding job hunting in the US. Instead, the 90 states' financial cushion is exactly what keeps the couch comfy. So we have an urgency mismatch between employers and job seekers, and that really explains the acute labor shortage, despite an employment population ratio, which is still 3% lower than pre-pandemic. In my opinion, that's really a source of future wage gains. Also, don't forget that the pandemic has laid bare the West's over-reliance on the global supply chain and the race to reshore production and jobs also is now fully on. This will also tighten domestic labor markets further and buttress workers' bargaining power domestically. But imagine if Biden's infrastructure bill passes, even a watered-down one. If you look at the most recent Atlanta Fed wage growth tracker, which I'm showing on chart 11, you can see that it's already breaking higher. What's interesting is that it's been used in the past few months by many macro pundits to argue that there was nothing to worry on the wage side. And that's also something that the Fed has been looking at to argue that it doesn't have a wage issue. What's interesting is that job switchers are seeing most of the wage gains, with the younger cohorts and lower skilled workers also pulling more than their usual weight at this stage of the labor cycle. And they're normally catching up to the cycle. This time, they're actually leading. So this pandemic-induced phenomenon will persist, especially with voters in the DM world moving resolutely to the left. And on that, I will avidly watch this week's election in Germany. Of course, you also have excess savings that are still plentiful. And so labor supply may actually be tightened permanently. To gauge the effects, because of course, what will really matter next year is, where is Nehru? At what point can we decide that the US is back to full employment? I think to gauge the effect on the Nehru or equilibrium unemployment rate, think that unemployment is around 4% in the UK versus 7% in France. Well, you know what the main difference is between the two countries that I know very well, is that the higher frictional unemployment is that there is a much higher frictional unemployment in France, where you get 80% of your salary for 2 years when you lose your job, versus basically a kick in the butt if you're working in UK. You therefore have to jump on the next job if you want to continue paying your rent. Looking at considering going back to the US, real wage analysis shows that workers are already playing a stronger hand than inflation. Many macro commentators are looking at a year-on-year increase in real wages and arguing that it's negative. But I think it's, you know, you can't look at August versus last August numbers because of base effect. So what I'm showing on chart 11 is actually the real wages, but not growth in real wages. And what you find is that wages in services sectors, real wages I'm talking here, have increased 3.1% over the crisis, so since early 2020. And you've got a 6% real increase in leisure and hospitality, which is even beating the 5% real increase achieved in financial services. So it's interesting here to see a real wage catch up in the service industries, which is also the lowest paid sector, like hospitality or care services. And it's interesting to see that we are effectively already redistributing wealth through a higher wage share in those sectors. Now, that's not something that happens only in the US. consider Germany. The most important factor there in the wage dynamics is the annual wage negotiation rounds. So in those rounds, trade unions are basically now basing their claim on current inflation. So it was 3.9% in August, but it could easily reach 5% in coming months before leveling off. So rather than, you know, considering the ECB's 2% target as it was in the past, they're now already using realized inflation. So if unions manage to pull this off, it would structurally shift the inflation dynamic. So one-off hikes perpetrate through, so one-off hikes in prices perpetrate through higher wages. The same thing is true in France. Wages are set there at the company level, so it's less of a macro phenomenon. However, a labor market recovery is already in full swing. The job centers saw offers jump 10% to new record highs this month, with demand exploding for restaurants and also in the food, transport, and health sector. Also, I should mention that half the offers are long-term contracts, which really emphasizes employers' prevailing optimism. Finally, you have to consider the UK, because where labor shortages are possibly the most acute due to the effect of Brexit. There, the Bank of England currently estimates that the underlying wage growth is trending around 5%.
Okay, Juliet, so as I assimilate the things that you're saying, it sounds like you think real wages are going to have a strong tendency to rise, but the question is going to be whether or not the Fed is going to let that happen.
Exactly, and obviously that's what will drive market as well. So firstly, let's think about those who will exit the labor market permanently, the boomers. They basically sit on a disproportionate share of total household wealth in the US, especially. And that's something you can see on chart 12. So for them, retirement will see them spend their wealth. And that should mean that their demand should be supported even outside employment. Meanwhile, real wealth will transfer to younger generations through inflation and obviously wage inflation if it happens. And that will be boosting aggregate demand in the process. The thing is that a hot labor market tends to lower income inequalities, leading to a greater aggregate propensity to spend rather than save, and boosting aggregate demand in the process. Inflation eats away at capital holders' real wealth. You know, let's think about it. Only the top 5% have the risk appetite to manage their whole wealth actively rather than hold it mostly through cash. And eventually, that will benefit the working class if their income grows and stops beating inflation, something that we haven't seen in the past 30 years. So I think the Fed will be late to recognize and act on this price-wage spiral because it's largely virtuous. And as proof of that argument, I'd like to cite a recent study which was presented at Jackson Hole this August, just a few weeks ago. It's entitled, What Explains the Decline in R-Star? Rising Income Inequality versus Demographic Shifts. The study basically suggests that the Fed is becoming aware of what I've been arguing for years, which is that income inequality goes much further than demographic shifts to explain collapsing final demand and obviously its corollary, the real equilibrium rate. So more money in fewer hands axes a nation's marginal propensity to spend out of both aggregate income and wealth. Indeed, the study reckons income inequality is really what caused the global savings glut. And the Kansas City Fed estimates that high-income households now save 3 to 3.5% points more of national income than was the case in the 1980s. Obviously, lower immigration and weak demographics will continue shrinking the labor force. But if higher wages boost aggregate earnings nonetheless, the macroeconomic and market dynamic may radically differ from the past few decades. So I think the collapse in yields over the past 20 years results from both weak demographics and the crumbling wage share of national income. As the former gets fully priced and the latter reverses, I think there is a case to be made that yields will pursue their recovery higher than pre-pandemic levels after the ongoing cyclical dip. And that's assuming that wage share duly mean reverts. And if you need to convince yourself on that, check the chart 14 of my chart pack, which indeed hints that equilibrium rates are closely linked with inequalities and the share of global wealth, which goes to the working class. In short, secondary inflation effects are absolutely necessary to consolidate post-pandemic reflation. Indeed, while higher goods prices are a double-edged sword for reflation, raising inflation but shrinking purchasing power, higher wages are an unquestionable boon to the underlying strengths of the economy, especially at this macroeconomic juncture.
Juliet, these musings on macro have been absolutely fascinating, but as you know, we've got a tough audience and fascinating is not good enough. You are in the business of linking these fascinating insights to actual trading recommendations and strategies to make money on this stuff. So what's your thinking? What, as we look ahead, where's the trade here?
So my bottom line is that labor supply will slowly recover, but not to pre-pandemic levels. This should keep the Fed dovish. Why? Because basically it will take a long time for unemployment to drop back to pre-crisis level. So this should keep the Fed dovish as far as rate hikes are concerned. Don't forget that the Fed is committed to not hike before full employment, before the economy returns to full employment. So in the process, the urgency mismatch between employers and job seekers will prop up wage growth beyond the initial price boost, ensuring that the initial burst of inflation broadens to the services industry. I think that's going to mean a slow return to full employment, and it strengthens the hands of those employed and keeps the Fed easy and increases the chance of lasting second-run effects from the initial spike in goods prices to higher wages. So in this vein, I was not really surprised to see that August NFP fell well short of analyst expectations. I think it reflects partly the Delta variant hitting close contact sectors such as leisure, hospitality, and healthcare. But it was much more informative to see the continuation of earnings growth through wages. So after all is said and done, an economy can produce aggregate income growth and fuel final demand in two ways: creating jobs or boosting real earnings from such jobs. Of course, markets have previously tended to prefer jobs to wage whose growth tends to signal inflation is starting to snowball, perhaps warranting tighter monetary conditions. But today, the Fed is looking for jobs and is rightly turning a blind eye to a virtuous wage-driven reflationary cycle. But in the end, what markets really fear is normalization and monetary normalization in a down cycle. But as the contractionary effect of higher goods starts moderating, the Fed should not and probably will not impede the true reflationary cycle, which will see income gains catching up consumption prices and reboot the cycle. In turn, that will allow for normalization to get priced in a relatively market-friendly way into 2022 at least. So that takes me to what you really want to hear, which is market-wise. I think inflation killed reflation from the beginning of the second quarter, triggering a correction in the global yield uptrend and a curve flattening. I think the near future should see transitory inflation moderate but stay firm, especially compared with the past decade. I think that means that markets are not right in pricing that spot breakevens will be converging to lower forward breakevens. I actually think that forward breakevens are too low, so I'm recommending long forward breakevens. Also, the second run of inflation should be friendlier to the working consumer, who should be able to use his newfound bargaining power to achieve substantial real wages gain. So I expect capitulation on the cyclical lull narrative into the ongoing Evergrande turbulences and the Fed, depending on China's monetary stance as economic weakness starts putting employment at risk, I think the end of the ongoing cyclical lull should prompt cyclical indices to erase the past quarter's underperformance and allow medium-term real yields to come way off their lows and start trending higher again in the move that should actually re-steepen global yield curve. Already, you can see that in the ongoing turbulence and with the global growth surprise index continuing to collapse lower, 10-year US yields have actually diverged and stabilized, hinting that the cyclical lull may be fully priced. Personally, I'll be looking to go back a short 10-year duration into the current risk-off dynamic. And I'm also looking for dollar upside to fade again quickly. I'm basically looking to go back long cyclical in index, and I'm looking there at European banks, which is super cyclical, but also R2K, small caps, which I think should be, you know, coming out of its 5 months consolidation range to eventually break higher.
Well, Juliet, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview, but before I let you go, I want to talk about what you do at JDI Research. Now, when I first met you, JDI Research was exclusively an institutional advisory firm. I like to think that Macro Voices has played a role in persuading you to open up your client base a little bit to some high-end retail. Tell us a little bit about what you do and who it's available to.
So with JDI Research, I am very focused on helping institutionals, but I also have a lot of family offices and high net worth clients. What I'm doing is helping them see through the noise to trade the underlying trends with conviction. We've been for 6 years now, and we've been going for 6 years, and our process has proved valuable to clients. As always, I'd like to thank you, Eric, for having introduced me through your show by giving your listeners a once-in-a-year offer on a JDI subscription. So get in touch either via email at juliette.declercq@jdiresearch.com or follow me on Twitter at @JulietteJDI, and I shall, you know, ensure that you know, you get the absolute best deal on JDI Research subscription.
Well, Juliet, we look forward to getting you back on the show in a few months for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Escrow.com is the payment system for buying and selling anything of value: cars, boats, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, fine art, collectibles, intellectual property rights, domain names, bringing in shipping containers from overseas, or even buying and selling entire businesses. It's simple to use. Either party sets up the transaction, then the buyer sends the funds to Escrow.com. The seller is then instructed to send the goods to the buyer to inspect. Within the inspection period, the buyer can return the items for any reason. After that, Escrow.com pays the seller immediately. Escrow.com is the world's most secure payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Over 2 million customers have transacted over $5 billion on Escrow.com, and eBay and Shopify use it for cars, boats, luxury watches, and business sales. It's available in the United States, Canada, and Australian dollars, euros, and British pounds. Never buy or sell anything online unless you use Escrow.com. Escrow.com is a subsidiary of Freelancer.com, listed on the OTCQX Best Markets under the ticker symbol FLNCF, and the Australian Securities Exchange under the ticker FLN.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Julia back on the show. I really enjoyed the tail end when she talked about how she's going to trade this all. And it was really interesting, her perspective, that the dollar is going to fade off of these highs, but also this idea that the cyclicals and maybe small caps might start performing again. I want to talk about that in some of the charts as we go here into the postgame.
Well, let's dive into it, Patrick. The chart deck is titled, Is the Market Correction Over? With a great big question mark. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. Now, if you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to the homepage, click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, is the market correction over?
Let's jump to page two, where we have the S&P 500 chart. And that 50-day moving average was a focal point for us throughout the last 6 months because it held almost every short-term correction till then. Now, we did have one decisive breakdown day that pretty much right across the board sent signals to all technicians, including those tracking the gamma flip zones for dealers and in the options market and all of the different areas that were the stress points for the market. And that breakdown really kind of opened that floodgate for that 100 plus point down day on an intraday basis. Now we're getting the reflexive snapback. And while certainly these two back-to-back days on the upside are positive on the very short term, I think the big hurdle and the big tell from the stock market is to come pretty much right off this pivot in the coming day or two. And maybe by Monday or so, we should have clarity on this. The way I look at this is that a 1 or 2 day snapback from an oversold condition is a typical response of a market. And whether the traders fade this rally or whether or not the bulls build on it is actually the real tell. And I think a sustained price action towards 4,500 would put this correction to bed and probably reopen the upside window. But I think the jury is still out on that. But what I wanted to do, Eric, was go to page three where we have the Russell 2000. And Juliet mentioned those small caps. And I really wanted to highlight that while the S&P 500 and NASDAQ were in very pronounced bull runs, that the Russell and the small caps after a huge reflation November surge that occurred where the Russell had that great 3-month run into February, it's been a 6-month trade range for the Russell and it has not participated. It has got no love throughout the whole period. And it's really interesting idea that this consolidation could be where a new bull breakout happens and maybe even relative strength emerges. I mean, if the idea that cyclicals and small caps outperform in this next cycle, it would be interesting to see whether we get a breakout of all of these highs really setting in motion that turn. And what I wanted to also kind of highlight as a part of that kind of small cap storyline and cyclicals is to touch on page four, particularly on the reopening trades. And to just kind of cherry pick one of the reopening trades is looking at the airlines. Now, of course, you got hotels, cruise lines, a whole series of different sectors that are labeled in this reopening trade. But what I thought was really interesting is that the airlines, which have been more or less in a market correction since March, also, you know, pretty much going on a 6-month correction, are attempting to break out here. And it's a really interesting question as to whether the trend of the NASDAQ and S&P outperforming in small caps and these reopening trades being the ones that had the brunt of the selling, will we see the rotation happen where these suddenly get money flow and start performing? I think it's a little too early to say this with certainty, but I think this is something really interesting to watch right now.
Patrick, let's move on to the Euro-US dollar currency cross on page five.
Well, you know, I wanted to touch back on to what Juliet was saying, where she was anticipating potentially a U.S. dollar to fade off of its recent strength. And in my mind, there's only one chart to watch out for this. That obviously, the Euro-USD is, on a trade-weighted basis, the biggest influencer of the dollar index. And what you can see is the euro has been in a very distinct downtrend, and it's retesting a major support line along its low. And I think that this is where you will see a shift in trend of the U.S. dollar if it was to emerge. And I just highlight how early it is to make a call that the euro is about to rally. But I think, you know, after hearing Juliet kind of discuss her narrative, I think it'll be really interesting to see whether or not this can get back to the 118, 119 level and start to show more of a consolidation pattern in the currency. Because if it does, that could be the basis from which the dollar can start becoming a little more bearish moving forward.
Let's move on to my favorite chart, crude oil futures, on page 6.
You know, you've been calling this oil move all along, Eric, but what I find really interesting is that we find ourselves at a very key technical overhead resistance. And after a three-day consolidation starting last week into early this week with these breakout candles, this may be the moment where a 52-week high actually occurs and we get a legit breakout. And I think that watching what happens here is going to be critical. I think this is going to be really interesting to see if technically, if we have this breakout, a push up to $78 to $80 for a short-term target. Obviously, you have a longer-term target, but a shorter-term target to $78.80 becomes very realistic.
Patrick, I agree with everything you say, and I think that the ingredients are all in place for this rally now to continue through the rest of the year and into next year. Let's move on, though, to the energy stocks. That's the XLE ETF over on page 7.
What I really just wanted to highlight here is that if oil is about to start another bull run, it is still early in the energy stocks to jump onto this and go for a ride. Like, we haven't even broken that summer consolidation to the upside from July to August, where these energy stocks have been more or less pinned. It'll be interesting to see whether or not, if oil breaks out to a 52-week high and this punches to a multi-month high out of the August-September ranges, I think there's plenty of opportunity to make some money on these energy stocks. It's something that I'm watching with my members as oil is approaching these major highs.
Patrick, I agree. And I think what's going on here is that the market is still discounting in the energy stocks the fact that U.S. production got clobbered pretty bad by Hurricane Ida. That's going to screw things up for some of these companies for a while to come. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, the big picture is great big secular rally. Price of oil's going up. It's got to be good for those companies in the long run. So it seems to me like it is an opportunity there. The other opportunity I want to talk about, though, Patrick, is the opportunity for our listeners to check out Big Picture Trading, your service, where you can get a free membership to check out Patrick's service and get Patrick's chart decks not just once a week, but every single day. Information's at bigpicturetrading.com or on page 8. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Juliet's slide deck and the chart deck we just discussed here in the postgame. There's also a link to an article from Bill Blaine on Is Evergrande a Symptom of a Deeper Malaise? And as well as an oil price article that the European energy crisis is about to go global. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend. That's Eric spelled with a K, and myself, @PatrickSeresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.